Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Reassurance is knowing our pensions will be supporting you in the years ahead. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension today.
Move to that next item right away then, because it is a very fast moving story. Today, ousted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro faces charges of narco-terrorism, while his wife Celia Flores is charged with weapon and drugs offences. It all began, if you were living under a stone, you might not know this, it all began on Saturday in an early morning attack when Maduro was captured by US Special Forces, transported to America and held in a Brooklyn detention centre. US President Donald Trump watched the entire operation live, saying it was like watching a television show that no other country in the world could have pulled off. Throughout this morning, TV images have been showing images of Maduro being transferred to court in Manhattan, where he is due to appear in the dock to face federal charges within the next hour. For more on this now, I'm joined on the line by David Blevin, US correspondent for Sky News, and here in studio by Ed Burke, assistant professor in the history of war at UCD. I'll go to you first, David. We've been glued to our TV this morning and through this afternoon here. What's been happening? We got a glimpse of Maduro himself, haven't we?
Yes, a series of extraordinary images from New York this morning, I suppose, at the end of a weekend of jaw-dropping moments. Just 3 days ago, I think it's important to reflect on the fact that Nicolas Maduro was president of Venezuela. And this morning, we see images of him shackled, being transferred across the river from the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York into a courtroom in Manhattan, where he and his wife Celia Flores are about to face some very serious charges.
Echoes, I thought of the O.J. Simpson, those overhead shots of the armoured car taking Maduro to that courtroom, and that transfer as well from the helicopter. Very dramatic scenes.
Yes, and of course, it is one thing for a celebrity to be front and centre on these occasions as they make that journey from a detention centre to a courtroom. Another thing altogether for a head of state of a country to be in that situation, because Maduro and his wife are going to now be charged with serious drug trafficking offences, serious weapons possession offences. The hearing is an arraignment, so it will be quite brief. They'll probably just verify their identities. They will read the charges aloud. A judge will decide if they are to be bailed or to remain in custody, almost certainly the latter on this occasion, and the date will be set for another hearing. Pam Bondi, US Attorney General, says they're going to face the full wrath of US justice, but legal experts here in the United States say this could become an awful lot more complicated further down the road, these proceedings, because of the debate around how international law has been applied or not applied in this case.
And I understand there was a queuing down and around the block for that court hearing all morning today. What more do we know about what conditions Maduro has been held in since that very dramatic capture and rendition, I suppose you could say, to New York?
I think we've seen more of him than you would usually see of prisoners in this situation. We saw the image of him in handcuffs, in a blindfold, with ear protectors on, initially when he was taken from his home in the dead of night onto a ship anchored off the coast of Venezuela, then flown to New York. And again, there were more images, what the Americans called the perp walk, as he walked off the plane surrounded by law enforcement. He was taken to the Drugs Enforcement Agency for yet another photo opportunity before he eventually made his way to the Metropolitan Detention Center. And I think, again, that's something to reflect on, just how keen the Trump administration is for the American population and for the world to see these images of how they are treating Maduro, because in many ways they have absolutely torn up the rule book in their approach to this matter, and they want the world to see that.
Indeed, but there has been some criticism from within the Republican Party itself in relation to this. And we go back again to the now arch critic of Trump, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yes, we know that the MAGA base, the Make America Great Again base, has been divided in recent months over Donald Trump's focus on foreign affairs. At the beginning of last week, he was hosting President Zelensky of Ukraine at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. The following day, he was hosting Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, in Mar-a-Lago. By the end of the week, he's leading this audacious military operation to capture, that's the word he used, the President of Venezuela. All of the focus on foreign affairs right now, while the American economy is struggling, while people are struggling with a cost of living crisis. And let's not forget, this is midterm election year. He's going to face the voters again, or at least his representatives are, come November. And some of them are deeply concerned because he was re-elected just over a year ago on a platform of putting America first. Some of them believe he is putting America first by the action he's taking, because they believe he is making America safer. But there are many believe he needs to shift his focus more to these issues around the economy at home and forget about what's going on elsewhere in the world.
And talking about the US Congress, they did not get forewarned about this operation.
They were very unhappy about it. I think it's fair to say there's serious disquiet on Capitol Hill here in Washington, A, because they were not asked for their approval in advance of the operation, B, because they know what happens when there is not a plan, a political plan for the future of a place, and there doesn't appear to be a very coherent one for Venezuela right now. They don't have to go very far back in their memories to think about what happened in Libya, what happened in Iraq, what happened in Afghanistan. They don't want America to be in the throes of another long war, and certainly not led there by Donald Trump, who vowed to put America first. But of course, the other thing I think they will be concerned about is just how the rest of the world is reacting to this. The question about international law and how it has been applied or not applied in relation to this matter.
Indeed. Thank you for that. That's David Blevin, US correspondent for Sky News there. We're just, as I was talking to David there, we're watching live pictures coming in at the feed from New York. Obviously, we're still waiting for that court hearing to get underway. And we're now looking at pictures of the United Nations hearing that was called for today. We're hearing that China's deputy UN envoy calling for the release of Maduro and his wife. We're seeing that Russian's UN envoy again calling for their release. US envoy to the UN saying there is no war against Venezuela or its people. We are not occupying a country, but we are. They are, according to Trump, from yesterday, running a country in Trump's mind. Ed Burke is with me, as I say, here in studio, assistant professor on the history of war at UCD. Ed, where to start with this? It is has been an extraordinary few days in international politics.
Oh, it really has. I mean, it's hard to think of a precedent for this. Also, not least because of the rather incoherent and varied explanations we've got. You know, first of all, it's about democracy. Second of all, it's about countering narcotics. Third of all, it's about oil and seizing oil. And I think that makes the job in the United Nations Security Council for the United States very difficult today. They can't simply say, well, under Article 51, we're just defending the US. This is an immediate, overwhelming threat to US national security. It'd be hard to make that argument, but if they simply cannot do that, given that's in no way doesn't have much traction now, given what the President Trump has said about seizing oil assets and changing the regime. So it's completely incoherent. There doesn't seem to have been, it was a very sophisticated military tactical operation, but where's the strategy?
Yeah, because I suppose we'll remember, if you go back to the invasion of Iraq, if you go back 23 years to that time, there was such groundwork laid there. Some would say, wrongly, but huge attempts were made to justify that invasion and to put some sort of legal status to it. There doesn't seem to be any sense of that for this operation.
Absolutely. And you have to remember, after 2003, I mean, most EU member states at the time did actually deploy troops to Iraq. There was lots of support in Europe for the multinational force in Iraq. There's been no diplomatic effort done here. And obviously, some people have cited President Noriega back in 1989. But at that time, the Panamanian military had actually attacked the US military in the canal zone in Panama. And indeed, a Marine lieutenant was killed. And, you know, the US administration at the time used that argument at the United Nations to make the case why they had to intervene. And a lot of countries went along with that. This time, the United States look really isolated in the UN.
But the response has been pretty muted, though, particularly across Europe.
Yeah, I mean, that's one word, Ukraine, right? So, you know, Europe, the European Union, European NATO is so reliant upon the US for intelligence, targeting, technical support, Starlink communications, etc., in anti-missile capabilities in Ukraine, that they feel that they are really, really boxed in here. And meanwhile, there's sort of, you know, increasing threats of a trade war that Europe desperately wants to avoid. I think this hypocrisy has been pointed out by many, not least Malaysia, South Africa, who have said that the Europeans have been lecturing them for a long time about Ukraine. And now here we are, and much of Europe is being very silent. Not all. Spain, France, of course, have intervened quite strongly.
But the crunch point will come if he moves further with his rhetoric on Greenland, won't it? Because not just with Europe, but with NATO.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, today we saw the Danish Prime Minister come out and say that Denmark is taking this very seriously. And this goes back to, you know, the US national security strategy. Trump has said very clearly that the Western Hemisphere, including Greenland, is going to be dominated by the United States. And it believes that, you know, the rules-based order, you know, working within NATO isn't sufficient, and that ultimately, therefore, Greenland needs to be ceded, there needs to be complete US dominance over the Arctic. And that has major, major implications for Europe, and not least in terms of the wider international system, the architecture that the European Union still cherishes, but is increasingly under threat, if not in life support. And of course, you know, for NATO, I mean, the idea that Denmark, one of the loyalist NATO allies the United States has had in recent decades in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and yet here they are and they're demanding the cessation of territory. It's quite remarkable, yeah.
Starmer looked very uncomfortable, Keir Starmer, when being pushed on this over the last couple of days.
He did. On the other hand, he has come out today and given resolute support to Denmark. And I think that's important, that, you know, I think perhaps the previous UK government may have avoided that. And he has consistently said that he wants to be with European NATO and he wants to develop European defence capabilities. And I think that makes what happened then at the end of last year even more sort of, you know, regrettable, that the EU and the UK couldn't come to an agreement over UK involvement in Europe's safe defence programme, this boosting of European defences. I think, you know, it's more urgent than ever, including for our EU presidency, we now get the UK and the EU back on the same defence page.
Where does this leave relations between Putin and Donald Trump? Because obviously Maduro and Putin had close connections.
Yeah, I mean, so in some ways this is a boost to Putin, right? Because he can say, spheres of influence, I get to do what I want in Ukraine, you get to do what you want to do in Latin America. There's a deal here. On the other hand, of course, yes, Venezuela, in terms of diminishing Russian allies in the world, Venezuela was important. Obviously, clearly the Assad regime has fallen. But, you know, in terms of this is difficult for Russia. On the other hand, the principle that, you know, international law does not apply, that the UN Charter can just simply be ripped up, that might is right. I mean, more broadly, that suits Putin.
It's pretty bleak, though, isn't it? I mean, it's very difficult to see how we can manoeuvre our way through this.
Well, I think President Rodriguez, so she has to balance, obviously, we've seen from the casualties that occurred during the operation, the Cubans have a very significant military and intelligence presence that, you know, that Venezuela relies upon very heavily. So, and Cuba believes that, the Cuban regime believes it's now in an existential struggle for survival against the US government, not least Secretary of State Marco Rubio, so she has to balance that. And on the other hand, I do think that President Rodriguez and already the Venezuelan regime realizes that because Trump is so transactional, that if they make a pretty generous offer on oil, that the United States may climb down in terms of its demand for substantial regime change, that they can sort of keep control of power, keep the military, keep the intelligence apparatus in place. while at the same time sort of satisfying Trump's demand for this, you know, huge strategic oil reserves that Venezuela has that are important. You know, I think a lot of US assessments, there is a logic here in terms of the US being able to tap into these very significant reserves, particularly from 2030 onwards. The problem for Trump is a lot of these reserves will not come on stream during his administration.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now, but we will be coming back to this later in the programme. But for now, Ed Burke, Assistant Professor in the History of War at UCD, many thanks for that.
And there were live television pictures coming in there a moment ago just of the in Caracas of the preparations to swear in the new Venezuelan leader, Delcy Rodriguez, and we'll bring you more on that as we come to it. Nicolas Maduro being transferred to a New York federal courthouse at the television pictures we're watching at the moment. Again, this constant pictures, the rolling pictures of the perp walk of a blindfolded Nicolas Maduro being escorted from one vehicle to another. So anyway, we'll bring you further developments on that if that court case gets underway between now and 6 o'clock.
Drive Time with Katie Hannan and Cullum O'Mungoin on RTE Radio 1.
I'm not guilty, I am a decent man. Those are the words of Nicolas Maduro, who along with his wife Celia Flores have just left a New York courtroom after pleading not guilty. Well, for more on this, we're joined by Harriet Alexander, senior US features reporter with the Daily Mail in New York. Harriet, good evening to you.
Hello.
It's been reported Nicolas Maduro has left the court after telling the judge he's still president of his country. What else did he have to say in court?
Yes, he said that he was unaware of his rights until they were read to him by the judge. He actually started to say, I am the legitimate president of Venezuela. I have been kidnapped. And the judge then cut him off and said, Mr. Maduro, there will be time for you to explain yourself, but now is not the moment. So Maduro, quite defiant, actually. I mean, as expected, he was never going to say, yes, I hold up my hands, I'm guilty. But the stage is set for an interesting few months, for sure.
And what's the rap sheet?
So he has been charged with 4 federal counts. They include narco-terrorism, cocaine trafficking, and several weapons offences, including possession of machine guns. For these, he could get up to life in prison.
And for Celia Flores, Nicolas Maduro's wife, did she speak only to say not guilty? Did she attempt to elaborate at any length as to her objections to the charges being laid against her?
No, it was her husband who was definitely the most vocal. They both had translators with them. They had headphones so that they could understand all the procedures. I mean, Maduro himself speaks a little bit of English. His wife, it's less clear. Certainly neither of them fluent enough in these grave circumstances to be without translators. But she was certainly a lesser presence in court than him.
And we can see television pictures of Nicolas Maduro being transferred back to the detention centre there. There's a number of armoured vehicles and other vans driving in a kind of a convoy. We're seeing the helicopter shots on television at the moment. What did Nicolas Maduro's lawyer have to say about the conditions in which he's been held and how he's been treated?
Well, he's being held at the Metropolitan Detention Center, which is a federal jail in Brooklyn on the waterfront there. So, you know, it's not very far as the crow flies from the courthouse in Manhattan. But of course, they transferred him by helicopter for security reasons so that they could avoid shutting down the whole of Lower Manhattan, essentially. It is not a pleasant place, that's for sure. There's several high profile people who have been held there and indeed are being held there. At present, Luigi Mangione, who's accused of shooting dead the healthcare executive last year, he is being held there. It's a place where people like Sean Diddy Combs have been held. They have all complained extensively about the cold, about the lack of privacy, about the food in particular. So it's quite a change for Maduro from the presidential palace.
Okay, and the proceedings, what 30 minutes long, were there much public interest on the outside, or were they kept well back by security?
Oh, yes, a great deal of public interest, as you can imagine, public and also the media, who were there before the crack of dawn. It's very cold in New York right now, but they were there. There was also a sizable presence of pro-Maduro protesters. These are people waving the Venezuelan flag, chanting against US imperialism and calling for the release of Maduro and his wife.
On St. Patrick's Day, 17th of March at 11 a.m. is the date for the next hearing, is it?
Yes, that's right. That's when he'll next be in court. And another date for you. It's actually, I believe, almost 30 years ago, but almost 40 years ago, but certainly to the day that Manuel Noriega was captured in Panama was the Saturday when Maduro was detained. So there's a lot of symbolism in that as well.
Harriet, thanks for joining us there. Harriet Alexander, senior US features reporter with the Daily Mail in New York.
Coming up, we'll be back with the weather.